Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Arvid Oggren. He is Vener Grand Fellow in the Department of Evolutionary Biology at Uppsala University. He is an evolutionary biologist studying genomic conflicts, and today we're going to talk about his new book, The Gene's Eye View of Evolution. So, Dr. Oggren, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me. Really excited.
Okay, so let's start perhaps with the most basic question here. What is the gene's eye view of evolution?
The gene's eye view of evolution is a framework for thinking about evolution by natural selection. It's a way of thinking that kind of turns the classic explanation somewhat on its head. So if in its original formulation, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection was a theory about individual organisms, that individual organisms that differ in how well they survive and reproduce, and if some of the differences that causes that variation is heritable, those traits will become more common over time. Now, with the emergence of population genetics in the early 20th century, it was realized that that kind of evolutionary change can be described as a change in certain genic variants or alleles, which is often why evolution textbooks often define evolution as a change in allele frequencies. Now, the gene's eye view takes that insight one step further and argues that evolutionary biologists are always better off thinking in terms of genes rather than in terms of organisms. So it takes the insight that you can describe evolution as a change in allele frequencies, but then kind of combines that with a form of agential thinking from the study of evolution, and often then think of genes as striving to maximize the chances of being transmitted to the next generation. And this is often why the gene's eye view is often called selfish gene thinking, following from the book of that title by Richard Dawkins, who very much introduced this way of thinking to a larger audience, that evolution is thought of as being a process that involves competing selfish gene housed in transitory organisms.
So we will get into the theoretical implications of the gene's eye view of evolution, mostly concerning levels of selection and things like that. But before that, and since you also go through the history of this idea in evolutionary biology, could you tell us, is there anyone we can point to that we can say was the first one to really formulate this idea? People think a lot about Richard Dawkins because of the book, but before him, was there anyone who perhaps came up with this idea first?
Yeah, so Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene, which was published in 1976, was absolutely crucial to introducing this way of thinking to a larger audience, both to fellow professional biologists, but in particular to a wider general audience. I'd say that the other book that is of kind of equal importance in this history was published 10 years earlier by the American George Williams. It's a book called Adaptation and Natural Selection. And this is a book that, in contrast to the selfish gene, was aimed at professional biologists, which meant that it's been read by fewer people, but among professional biologists or professional evolutionary biologists in particular, it's had a kind of profound influence on the field. And here I would argue is the first time someone is clearly introducing what is now known as the gene's eye view of evolution. With those two books, then you can point to other names earlier on, whether kind of writings by Bill Hamilton, also by Ronald Fisher, who introduces many of the kind of the key concepts. But it was Williams and Dawkins that kind of synthesized that and really introduced it in a kind of cohesive, comprehensive way for the first time.
And the sort of phrase, the selfish gene, doesn't it imply in any way any sort of anthropomorphization or not?
I mean, in a way, yes, of course, genes can't be selfish in the way that we say that a human can, or even that another kind of an animal can be, and that way we can talk about it in a formal evolutionary way. Selfish is used in a way to mean that you should expect genes to behave as if, and this is kind of the key phrase, that as if that they are trying to maximize the representation in the next generation. Now, why that can be confusing is that often the best way for a gene to do that is to cooperate with other genes in the genome. And most genes and most traits in most organisms are the product of the kind of orchestrated effort of multiple genes acting in concert. But by this way of thinking, each gene is doing that to kind of in their own self-interest. And that is the way that is selfish is used here. It is a kind of anthropomorphizing in that you are using this kind of heuristic of personification. If I was a gene, what would I do? The benefit of that, I think, is that in some ways, kind of anthropomorphizing works better for genes than it does for animals, which is another part of biology where you're often accused of anthropomorphizing, just because DNA so clearly are not selfish or happy or, you know, any other sort of kind of human trait, but instead it kind of becomes clear that it is a way to help our thinking that can then be used to generate a hypothesis that can then be expressed in a more formal way.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about this way of thinking about things or this approach that comes associated with the gene's eye view of evolution, that is the so-called replicator vehicle approach, because that perhaps also puts into perspective how we should think about organisms or individuals, and then perhaps we can get into the levels of selection question.
Yeah, so the replicator vehicle distinction is probably the most fundamental concept that is being that's introduced by the GeneSight view of evolution, and it's a way that argues that evolution involves two separate complementary entities. The first are what is known as replicators. So these are the entities of which copies are made. In practice, this usually means genes, though it's also kind of crucial to concepts like memes and so on, which we could get into. But the replicators are what are which copies are made and what is being passed on from one generation to the next. This is contrasted then with vehicles, which are the entities that actually interact with the environment or kind of, and which houses the replicators. Now, the crucial difference between them is that vehicles are present in one generation and that's it. They are kind of a unique combination of the genes that it carries and the environment in which it lives and their interaction, whereas the replicators are kind of conceived to be these immortal entities passed on from one generation to the next. And this leads them to one of the kind of fundamental claims of the genes I view, and that is that genes are the ultimate beneficiary of natural selection, because they and they alone are what is being passed on from parent to offspring, which is a kind of a criteria not fulfilled by other entities.
Mm-hmm. So if we are to accept this view, then, and perhaps in a bit we can get into the question of whether the gene's eye view of evolution is really widely accepted by evolutionary biologists or not, but if you accept it, how do you approach debates within the realm of levels of selection? I mean, does it still make sense to try to understand things from an individual perspective, from a group perspective, or not?
Yeah, I mean, the genes I view has been immersed in the broader levels of selection debate since its conception. We mentioned George Williams' Adaptation and Natural Selection just a moment ago, and the subtitle of that book was A Critique of Some Contemporary Evolutionary Thought. And the contemporary evolutionary thought that he had in mind was the kind of sloppy use of adaptation that he thought that many people in biology engaged in. And in particularly, he took aim at these kind of what is unknown as naive group selection, arguments that a lot of behavior that animals engage in are for the good of the group or for the good of the species, even. And he argued that this is often an explanation that is invoked without actually carefully articulating hypotheses about how this would actually evolve or without any empirical foundations. And he argued that instead of thinking in terms of groups, you're often better off thinking in terms of genes. Now, the genes view then has often argued that thinking in terms of genes is better than thinking in terms of individuals or in terms of groups. And sometimes this has been set up as a kind of straightforward empirical hypothesis of the two alternatives. Sometimes, however, proponents of the gene view has often has presented this rather not as a process, but as a perspective, that a gene view is kind of a complementary perspective to thinking in terms of, say, individual level selection. And a good example of this is the relationship between the gene view and inclusive fitness, where often the two has been presented as just kind of two ways of articulating the same point, that a gene acts as if trying to maximize its own transmission, whereas an individual is expected to behave as if trying to maximize its inclusive fitness. And Dawkins famously, in the extended phenotype, likened this to the two ways of looking at the famous Necker cube illusion, where kind of you see a 3D cube drawn on a paper, and you can kind of see from two perspectives. That he argued is kind of the GeneSci view's relationship with inclusive fitness.
And since you're mentioning inclusive fitness theory, I mean, because it is based on genetic relatedness, I mean, people who think about things from that approach, are they focusing on genes or individuals in that case?
Yeah, so I mean, inclusive fitness is a property of the individual organism. It's the organism who has an inclusive fitness, and it's the individual organism that is in full control of trying to maximize its inclusive fitness. It has historically a strong association with a gene side view, partly because of kind of the work done by Richard Dawkins. Indeed, probably the very first time that he or someone else used the term selfish genes, or the kind of the metaphor that genes should be expected to behave selfishly, comes from his own notes when he was still a graduate student, stepped in to do the lectures on animal behavior when his PhD advisor was away on sabbatical. And he was going to introduce the concept of inclusive fitness to his students. And to do that, he kind of came up with this way, a kind of a GeneSci way of thinking about the process. Now, inclusive fitness is often taught in conjunction or thought about in conjunction with kin selection, the process by which you take into account the social relationship between individuals, and the idea that a lot of costly social behaviors can evolve if they are primarily directed towards kin or to genetic relatives. And I would say ultimately, I think inclusive fitness is an individual level process. And in Gene's view, in many ways, tries to make us move away from thinking in terms of individual organisms. So though the two concepts, the Gene's view and inclusive fitness, are intimately linked, both historically and how they came to be, they can sometimes come into tension. And there are, in the book, I introduce some of these kind of classic complaints from proponents on the GeneSci view that Bill Hamilton in particular, who is the father of the inclusive fitness concept, did not really kind of complete his own revolution and really abandon the individual organism as the central unit of explanation and fully commit to a GeneSci view.
And particularly about group selection, I mean, do you think that there's any version of it that would make sense for people who adopt the GeneSci view of evolution? Because, I mean, I've had some group selectionists on the show, and some other prominent ones like E.O. Wilson more recently. For example, I remember reading in his book, The Social Conquest of Earth, something that I can't really properly evaluate myself, because he talks about mathematical models and comparing the evolution of particular traits from a kin selection slash inclusive fitness perspective and from a group selection perspective. And he says, for example, that for some of them, group selection is better fit to explain them. But then we have some issues there, because for groups, I mean, it's hard to define a group, and they are not exactly contained in terms of their genetics and stuff like that. So, I mean, what is your perspective on it?
Yeah, I mean, group selection occupies an almost uniquely contentious position within the history of evolutionary theory, particularly during the last half century or so. And the genes view very much has been at the heart of many of those debates. The first of all, of course, it grew out of a rejection of a certain kind of group selection models, those that were very popular in the 1960s and around there. So the first thing to note is that the group selection models we're talking about today are really quite different from the ones that were criticized by Williams and Dawkins when their first books came out, and that the kind of modern form of group selection is a much more sophisticated kinds of models, and models that I think have served a proper role in the evolutionary biology. The second of all is to point is about the replicated vehicle distinction, that the replicated vehicle distinction you can use to argue that a gene side view in principle is compatible with both individual level and group level selection, because the replicators in all instances is the gene, whereas the vehicle in principle could be the individual or it can be the group. Mm. Or in things like cancer, the vehicle would be the individual cell. But in all those cases, they can be also be approached by that the gene is the replicator and the gene is the ultimate beneficiary of it. So in that way, the gene side view is somewhat tangential to the classic group selection question. Lastly, then, one kind of major result of the debate over inclusive fitness and group selection during the past 15 to 20 years of the debate is that in many cases, you can come up with the same prediction, whether you're using a inclusive fitness or a group selection model, that they will predict the same direction of evolutionary change, but they are invoking a slightly different kind of phenomenon. And sometimes some have used that to argue that it's just a personal preference, whether you use an inclusive fitness and a group selection argument. And I'm somewhat of two minds there. On the one hand, I think that in biology, we will always have multiple ways of modeling it. We will never have one grand unified mathematical theory in the way that you can at least aspire to in parts of fundamental physics. So in that way, I think you just go ahead and use whatever you find most helpful in generating hypotheses that can be tested empirically, which at the end of the day is what truly matters in biology, is making empirical predictions and testing those. At the same time, I think that is a little bit of a disappointing attitude, but we should strive to come up with models that are kind of causally unified, that just because you can come up with the same prediction in an inclusive fitness model and a group selection model doesn't mean that they're causally the same. They are making different claims about the world. And I think we should make some effort to try to understand how they interrelate. So in summary, I would say that group selection has a role to play in our modern evolutionary theory. They can be properly done, and they often are at least as sophisticated as any other kind of mathematical model. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is an interesting debate to be had how they relate to other kinds of mathematical formalization, and in particular, kind of how they fit together with inclusive fitness models, which has been so tremendously successful empirically over the years.
Yeah. I think that's why I mentioned mathematical modeling and the book by E.O. Wilson, because, yeah, we get really into that issue that Sometimes it seems that for many traits, if you approach it mathematically from an inclusive fitness theory perspective or a group selection perspective, you get more or less the same results. So, I mean, at the end of the day, if you are able to make predictions and test them empirically, perhaps the issue then is more theoretical, perhaps in terms of how you explain things from an inclusive fitness versus a group selectionist perspective.
Yeah, I think sometimes they are, you can view these different kinds of models as different ways of carving nature at its joint, that depending on how you model the world, different things will stand out, and that will always be a good thing in such a messy field as biology. But it is also a debate that has been has suffered from that people mean different things by the same words, it's like down to the very basic meaning of what a group should be and how you measure group fitness. Today, when we say that this is a group selection model, we often measure fitness not at the group level per se, but in terms of individual levels, how many offspring individuals have. Whereas historically, there's been an argument that what ought to be called group selection is when you measure group fitness in terms of the number of daughter groups. But, you know, and this was the argument that John Maynard Smith had, and I would say, unfortunately, that is not what we mean by today. Today, that older use of measuring fitness in that way is rarely used. But most often, when people say that they have a group selection model, they have a model that is where you account for some levels of group properties, and but still measure fitness at the individual level. I've read one last thing I would add, I think, is that this debate has really benefited during the last 25 years or so of the major transitions perspective that introduced by John Maynard Smith and H. Judd Murray in particular, that that all levels of life you have had these transitions from entities that were previously able to survive and reproduce on their own can now only do so as part of a larger whole. For example, a major example of that would be the evolution of the multicellular organism from freely replicating cells. And there, of course, you can think of the multicellular organism as a form of cellular group selection, but most of the time we don't express it that way. But on some level, you used to have things that were reproducing individually and now only do so in a group. And I think that has added, really kind of made us view this debate in a whole new light.
So before moving on to some other specific topics, let me just ask you perhaps a couple of general questions. Is the Jin's eye view of evolution generally accepted by evolutionary biologists?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I would say most people think of it that it has at least some use in evolutionary biology. One story I think perhaps that can illustrate is that a key reason for me wanting to write this book is that when you ask people about their views on it, you ask colleagues in evolutionary biology about it, you quite often get two rather different replies. That some will say, you know, yes, the Jin's eye view is the only way or the main way to think about evolution, and everyone knows that. And then you go and you talk to another group of colleagues, and they say, "Oh no, the Jin's eye view was, you know, debunked in the 70s, and everyone knows that." In that kind of contrast, which is a contrast that you don't only find among professional biologists but also among lay people, that there's a concept that has strong supporters and fierce critics, both among professionals and among general readers. It isn't that kind of that intersection that really got me interested. So for me, it really came out of that. I did my undergraduate training in Scotland, in the UK, where the Jin's eye view, I would say, traditionally has been rather strong, is perhaps the stronghold of it in. Then I came to North America, where alternative perspectives have played a much more prominent role. So when I first started hanging out as a graduate student with you know, friends and fellow graduate students who came from the US and from Canada, who had turns out a rather different point of view than I did on many of these kind of major theoretical questions in evolutionary biology. And it was in those very stimulating and fun debates that my interest in this kind of questions grew out of. So I can't give you, I'd say that in general, people see at least some role for it, but whether they see that it is the major way, I think is an open question. Indeed, I think it would be quite fun to do this kind of formal proper polling on this issue and on many issues in evolutionary biology. Evolutionary biology is a fascinating mix of debates that can be settled quite straightforwardly with empirical data, and certain debates that are more of this variety of how we kind of general frameworks, which aren't really, is not going to be a brilliant experiment or, you know, a super fantastic mathematical model that is going to sway people one way or another on this in a really decisive way.
So let me ask you then, when it comes to alternatives to this approach and way of thinking about evolution that people point to, what are the strongest ones?
I think the strongest kind of rivaled framework is the one that stems from the conditions for evolution that was first developed or kind of majorly developed by Richard Lewontin, that he argues that you need three ingredients for evolution by natural selection to occur in a population. And that is that you need to have variation that is linked to variation that needs to be heritable and needs to be linked to fitness. And if those three are satisfied, then this population of whatever that is can evolve. And this is an entity that can be made of individuals, it can be groups, it can be cells, or it can be genes. And there's no reason to privilege one level or the other, that any system that satisfies these three requirements is going to evolve. And this has then kind of been similar. Other people have developed similar accounts. Perhaps the most sophisticated of those is the philosopher Peter Garvey Smith's Darwinian populations, which is a way of trying to articulate this in this kind of Darwinian populations, that as he calls them. And I'd say that in some ways you could argue that this is a more is a better way of thinking, because it only involves one sort of entity. You don't need to have both the replicator and vehicles, but it's just one entity. It also emphasizes that heredity need not work, need not include replicators. What you need is just that you have a correlation between parent and offspring, right. The mechanism of how that heredity works is not fundamental. You can develop an account that involves other kinds of heredity mechanisms. I would say that on this planet, in the way that life functions here, the replicator vehicle distinction has many good things to offer. But I think you can also concede that the kind of this Lewontin condition, this Lewontin approach, can be said to be more general at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Does the gene's eye view of evolution connect or relate in any way to adaptationism?
Oh, I think yes, very much so. I think the gene's eye view grew out of a tradition in evolution biology that takes adaptation to be the central problem that the theory of evolution needs to explain. That it is in order to kind of explain what the kind of the appearance of design, that is what the theory of evolution really, that kind of was its major achievement, that it provided a naturalistic account for how a kind of a purely mechanistic process such as evolution can account for this striking feature of the living world. So it kind of, I would place it firmly in that strand of thought within evolutionary theory.
Mm-hmm. How does it make sense of phenomena like pleiotropy and polygenic traits?
Yeah, so I mean, so to start with pleiotropy, that one gene may have different phenotypic effects depending on, say, the environment or when in the life cycle the gene is being expressed. For example, they may have one effect early on in the life cycle or and a different one, sometimes even in the opposite direction later on in the life cycle. So some have argued that the genes have used struggles to account for these kind of environmental effects, if we zoom out a little bit. I think there's some truth to that, that it's like the genes have works at its best when the interactions between are somewhat are rather simple. For example, they're kind of additive, as they say, when the phenotypic effect is simply the sum of the different loci involved, and it's kind of insensitive to the environment. That being said, I think the genes have can handle both pleiotropy and or any kind of polygenicity. So when a phenotypic trait is a product of multiple genes. So one thing I think that should be emphasized is that from under the gene side view, the whole concept of environment is conceptualized in a much expanded way compared to how we perhaps normally think about it. And this is a way of thinking that goes back all the way to Ronald Fisher, who showed that from an allele's point of view, what should count as the environment is not just kind of what goes outside of the organism, you know, the temperature, the pH, or humidity, or whatever. But from an allele's point of view, it includes also the gene, the other allele that's located at the same homologous site, the rest of the genome, and also all the other alleles that are segregating in the gene pool in which this allele finds itself. And the way that you use that then is that you're interested in kind of the average effect that this particular allele has in all possible combinations of environment. So the genes of you, I think, can be struggled sometimes with these kind of genetic complexities, but there's nothing in it that means that it can't handle those kinds of scenarios.
Right. So in the book, another big topic you tackle is sexual selection. Could you perhaps give us a brief overview of how people nowadays think about sexual selection and if the gene's eye view of evolution played the role there?
So sexual selection is the kind of selection that is involved not in how well an organism survives, but its ability to reproduce. And kind of classic examples are its ability to compete or attract mates in doing so. I think the main lesson that a gene's eye view can teach us is that what is good for the gene is not necessarily what is good for the organism. That a gene's eye view always think of that the traits that you see shouldn't be thought as being for the good of the organism, but should be for the ultimate beneficiary of the gene or genes that are underlying that. And that is a way then to kind of make sense of either really showy sexual ornamentation that, for example, males display to attract females. And it's also then a way to make sense of other traits that may be harmful to the individual itself, such as, example, in social insects or kind of worker sterility and other forms of eusocial behavior.
Mm-hmm. So when we talked about group selection, perhaps I should have mentioned this because one of the things that group selectionists talk a lot about when it comes to explaining how it evolved is altruism. So how can we make sense of the evolution of altruism from a gene's eye view perspective?
So the kind of the major insight there from a gene's eye view is that the what truly matters at the end of the day is not whether the behavior of the individual is good for the individual, but whether it's good for the gene or genes underlying that behavior. That from a gene's eye view, it doesn't matter if you a copy of you as a gene is transmitted through the organism in which you reside, or if a copy of you is transmitted through another individual in the population, that the individual that you reside has some kind of causal influence on their ability to survive or reproduce. And here then comes link to inclusive fitness and also then to kin selection, that it really brings home the importance of genealogical relatedness as an explanatory factor in explaining why certain lineages evolve these kind of striking forms of social behavior, where you, in the most extreme cases, have a complete separation of a reproductive reproductive and sterile castes within a population. That from a gene's eye view, it doesn't matter if it is the individual that you are in that reproduces, or whether it's an individual that you are related to at high enough degree that is reproducing. And here then, the gene's eye view then becomes a very helpful way of thinking about why that is, that relatedness becomes. Now, and then I think you should emphasize that then you can then model this insight, the importance of relatedness in this case, in various ways. You can go out looking, focusing on genealogical relatedness, and you can model this in, for example, using inclusive fitness way. You can go out, measure to what extent relatedness is especially high in these populations in nature. But also, you know, you can also emphasize these kind of mechanisms like green beards and things that from a gene's eye view, it is the relatedness between those specific loci that matters, not necessarily the gene-wide relatedness.
Mm-hmm. So could you tell us, because sometimes I hear this criticism coming from people, evolutionary biologists who are not big fans of the gene's eye view perspective. Does the gene's eye view perspective ignore biological processes like development? I mean, because I know there's been lots and lots of debate throughout the decades between developmental biologists and evolutionary biologists, particularly when it comes to things like so-called genetic determinism and the role that genes play versus the environment or ecological conditions. So what would you have to say about that?
Yeah, so I'd say evolutionary theory in general, and probably the gene's eye view in particular, has had a somewhat troubled relationship with development for a long time. And this kind of criticism from developmental biologists that contemporary evolutionary theory does not account for the complexities of development well enough goes back a long way, almost as back to the modern synthesis itself, that focus almost exclusively on evolution as changes in evolution as a change in allele frequencies. The classic defense from the gene's eye view has been that the development and the questions that the gene's eye view answers and the questions that developmental approaches answer are different questions, so they can't really be in competition with each other. That the gene's eye view argues that it is about what is being transmitted, and that often the questions about development are proximate and not about the ultimate beneficiaries of selection. That and this term is used as a justification for what's now known as a black boxing development. I would say that in many ways that the gene's eye view is really good at highlighting certain parts of evolution by natural selection and how it interacts with genetics. But it does so by kind of ignoring other parts. So development, it doesn't really have a certainly great answer to it, more than that often that is not the part that matters. Then there is, I think, a separate question of how often details of development do matter for evolutionary outcomes. And there are certainly very thoughtful people who argues that it does, and that are kind of traditional evolution explanations put too much emphasis on genes, and that there are good reasons to think that genes aren't or shouldn't be considered as privileged during developmental processes. So yeah, yes, all that to say that, yes, I think that the critique from developmental biologists is well taken, and it often has represented some of the most ambitious critiques, I think, of the GeneSight view.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that when it comes to trying to understand proximate versus ultimate explanations for particular traits, behaviors, do you think that perhaps a theoretical perspective like the one put forth by Nico Tinbergen and these four questions would be helpful here?
Absolutely. I mean, generally rather in favor of maintaining multiple perspectives in the study of evolution, and to be clear that there are many complementary questions in evolution that are important, and that the crucial thing is a lot of debates can be moved forward just by clarifying that what questions we are talking about, and that often you can realize that you are indeed interested in slightly different kinds of questions, maybe one of the different questions of Tinbergen's. Then there is, of course, I think a kind of the related question, the kind of the more normative question of, are there certain questions that are more important than others? Like, should we spend more time thinking about the ultimate rationale, the kind of the adaptive question? Is that question more important than others? And from the GeneSight view, this kind of what is sometimes known as the beneficiary question, like what is the ultimate beneficiary of natural selection, has a kind of unique, particular, and especially important role that they argue that is the most important, and only the gene satisfies that or can be the beneficiary, and that's why genes deserve this special position in our evolutionary explanation. And I have some sympathy for that, but kind of going back to the general point that biology is messy, and we will always need multiple perspectives, I think we should try to apply as much of them as we can, but we also do need to spend some time trying to think about how these different questions and models that then we may come up with, how they relate to each other, and here I think the intersection between inclusive fitness and inclusive selection models is a good example of that. But also I think there's a debate to be had: are certain questions more important than others? And we as a field ought to spend most of our time trying to answer that rather than others.
Mm-hmm. So let's now talk a little bit about cultural evolution, because that's something that Richard Dawkins, for example, also tackles. Initially in his The Selfish Gene book, talking about memetics as a field, do you think that the idea of meme and this approach memetics have been successful in terms of trying to make sense of culture, of human culture in this case, and cultural evolution?
That is an interesting question. I think memes, of course, has been a hugely influential, the concept of memes has been a hugely influential meme in of its own right. Mm-hmm. And I think memetic as a concept, my impression is that it was very helpful and important in moving the field of cultural evolution forward. It stimulated a lot of debate and got some really enthusiastic supporters, people like Dan Dennett and others. But it also has been many critics of it, which is also, I think, can be a very helpful thing for a field, because it moves the field forward. Now, cultural evolution is not my area of expertise in any way, but it's my impression is that when you pick up kind of an introductory textbook in cultural evolution, say take someone, one of the reasons why by someone like Tim Levins, memetics play a rather minor role in those books. They are introduced as, here's this idea that has been contentious, and it was like it moved the field forward. But my impression is that today other approaches play a much more important role. And if anything, they seem to have more in common with this kind of Lewinson approach to articulating the general principles of evolution by natural selection than the memetics one. I perhaps should say that the way that memetics originated is that, so this is in the last chapter of the first edition of The Selfish Gene, mm-hmm. where Dawkins turns his attention to cultural evolution, having spent the first part of the book talking about organic evolution. And he wants to come up with a word that would play, that would kind of have the same role as genes do in the study of organic evolution. And he settles then on a meme. So a meme is meant to be the kind of the cultural replicator in the way that the gene is that for organic evolution. So there is a minor irony lacking here in the way that the concept of replicators is kind of introduced to free the concept from the kind of material constraint of what a gene actually is materially, so that you just think about the kind of these properties of replications instead. And memes is an example of kind of you take that insight into the realm of cultural evolution. And it seems though that a lot of the problems that memes run into as a concept are those that actually link back to the material basis of genes, that it's quite hard to figure out exactly what the equivalent of an allele is in memetics and how like the competition between different alleles is meant to work. And whereas this kind of question of, you know, what counts as a gene in organic evolution arises, how long should a gene is be and so on. And even though the genes are somewhat agnostic about these details and quite comfortable with fuzzy edges around it, it is linked to proper biological processes like recombination and linkage and so on. Again, things that are hard to see exactly how they will work in the realm of cultural evolution. And it is my reading that it is, in many ways, it is the failure to translate those kind of insights into cultural evolution that has meant that memetics hasn't been able to have the same influence in the cultural evolution field as it has in the study of organic evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, just to make a short comment here, because I don't want to push you too much on that topic, since you mentioned that you're not specialized in cultural evolution. But I mean, I've had people on the show like Susan Blackmore, who is one of the major figures in memetics, and then people from the sort of the so-called California School of Cultural Evolution. I mean, Peter Richardson, Robert Boyd, Joe Henrich, and others, and then on the Paris School of Evolution, like Hugo Mercier, and I'm going to have Dan Sperber later this year. I mean, it seems to me, at least from my reading and by the questions I asked them, that, for example, someone from the California School of Evolution, they have an approach that is much more theoretically robust than memetics. They are able to go around the question of what is really a unit of a selection in cultural evolution. I mean, they don't have to tackle that question at all to be fruitful and productive. And I mean, and it seems to me that also they are able to generate hypotheses that are much more testable from a scientific perspective than memetics. So, I mean, that's just my comment. I don't know if you want to say anything about it, but I mean, at least personally, it seems to me that their approach is much more convincing than memetics.
Well, I guess first, it seems like you really have been able to get the full range of perspectives. I think Blackmore has pushed the idea of memetics further than perhaps anyone. And I think her book on the topic, The Meme Machine, I think it's called, remains, I think, the most lucid articulations of this whole concept. But I think I am with you that it is my impression that there are these other approaches, perhaps as represented by what you call the California School of cultural evolution, that has, at the moment at least, are dominating the field.
Yeah. So perhaps just to finish, a couple more general questions. So Does the Jin's view of evolution have anything to say about human nature? Because, I mean, this has been, whatever one means by human nature, this has been a very big topic in evolutionary biology, particularly since the introduction of things like sociobiology. So.
Yeah, the genes view very much came about just as these debates about human nature really kicked off again. I mean, evolutionary theory has always had a contentious or sometimes awkward relationship with debates about human nature. Just a year before the publication of the Selfish Gene, E. Wilson Sociobiology came out with the big debate that followed. And a lot of the arguments over the Dean's view, early on at least, played out in the context of the sociobiology debate. And here I think it is worth highlighting that, like, the Selfish Gene and the language that we used in that book really kind of prompted those kinds of strong reactions in a way that adaptation natural selection did not, even though on a more perhaps technical level about the genes as the ultimate beneficiaries, even though Williams that not do not use the terms replicators and vehicles, those kind of ideas are latent in there. And those kind of more technical debates, that book did not prompt that kind of reaction. So one, I think, is this kind of use of selfish, and to what extent selfish genes make selfish people, and those kind of debates it certainly played right into. Perhaps one thing that's worth saying that both Dawkins and Williams had in common is that both had a rather bleak view on the universe in many ways. That they thought, Williams famously described natural selection as a wicked old witch, that the natural selection often leads to very cruel outcomes, results in a lot of suffering. But that is then that observation in of itself means that we have very little to gain from studying evolution by natural selection to learn from how we want then to want to organize our societies. And I think both Williams and Dawkins were quite clear on that point, that we will have to look elsewhere for inspiration for how to organize our societies. But perhaps also that my impression is also that both of them were not as interested in humans as others have been, that they primarily were interested in describing the evolution of other organisms, but that they, in particular Dawkins, then wrote about it in such a way that inevitably will land you in the middle of those kinds of debates.
So just one last question, and perhaps picking up on that part about the bleak view of the universe. I mean, this is both a scientific and philosophical question. Do you think that the Jin's view of evolution has any moral implications or anything to say about the moral nature of the universe, or is that just something that perhaps people can arrive at from a philosophical perspective and not really directly from the scientific view we are talking about here?
Yeah, so I do think that there is much to the argument that you can't derive an is from an ought from an is, that just because the way we just because you that there's no contradiction in that we study evolution by natural selection, which can often be an awfully cruel process. That doesn't necessarily say anything about how we should be against each other. In the same way, there's no contradiction in the physician scientist both studying the properties of cancer and working day and night to eradicate it. I think to me, the great value of the Jin's eye view is that despite its limitations, which there are several, it is a tremendously helpful way to think about evolution by natural selection. That is, it's a very helpful thinking tool. But if there's kind of one argument that runs through my book is that the Jeans I View is a helpful thinking tool, but just like with all tools, you need to understand what it was designed to do. So kind of by appreciating the history of the concept, where it came out of, what problems it takes to be the central ones that we as a discipline must be able to answer, you're able to use it to use its great strength and use it to your advantage in generating empirical hypotheses that can then be tested.
Okay, great. So the book is again the Jeans Eye View of Evolution. Would you like to tell people where they can find you and your work on the internet before we go?
The main way you can find me is on Twitter, where I can be found under Arvid Agren. You can also find more information about my work on arvidagren.com.
Okay, great. I will be leaving links to that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Agren, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for the opportunity to join you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching the interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please consider supporting the show. It's thanks to people like you that it keeps running. I will leave links in the description box to Patreon and PayPal. Any amount, even just $1 per month, would already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per Erga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimir, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whitting, Bernard Arnold Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Colombo, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cussen, Ivan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslin Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Weira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Desaraújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roff, Yannick Punter, Adana Ruzmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidi, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, My producers, Isar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafinia, Kian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vanagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardis France, and Thomas Trumbull, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.